Stone Fences, Hot Ale Flips, Rattleskull, Wassail, Grog, Mimbo. Imagine waking every morning and drinking a half pint of rum just to get yourself started. Today, we'd classify that as an addiction, and you'd probably be recommended to go to a place like an addiction treatment center. But in colonial America, it may have been the norm. Join us today on An Incomplete History as we discuss just how drunk early Americans really were. Hello and welcome to An Incomplete History.
I'm Hillary.
And I'm Jeff.
We're your hosts for this weekly history podcast.
So, good afternoon, Hillary.
Good afternoon. How you doing?
Pretty good. I am not drinking like a colonial American today.
No, I'm not either. I was going to make some tea, but I didn't. And then I didn't have any alcohol either. So, I mean, I'm not in the spirit of it right now, I guess.
You're just not a patriot.
Well,
how's the weather out there?
I mean, if I wasn't drinking tea, then I would be a patriot, right? So if I had coffee, then I would have been a patriot.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That's true. How's the weather?
You know, I don't have anything exciting to report about the weather right now. It's just kind of
like me fine. Neither.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Last week was
yeah, so me
exciting,
neither.
And now it's just like, oh, it's kind of like just normal out.
Yeah. So weather report today is kind of boring, which is good because I think we have enough messed up stuff to talk about today.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Like what we have to talk about is like so more, much more exciting than the weather.
Oh yeah, completely. I want to say kind of before we start this, Hillary and I both are familiar with this book and it's from 1981. It's called The Alcoholic Republic, An American Tradition by W.J. Rohrabaugh. And it's a really influential book, and a lot of the stuff we're going to talk about comes from Rohrabaugh. And a lot of the data we're going to talk about when we talk about how drunk early Americans really were, it's up for debate right now, right? We've got conflicting records, and you know, some primary sources from the period indicate an amount larger than we're going to talk about, and some indicate an amount smaller. Hopefully, one of the things we can get to today is historians kind of have to consider multiple sources and kind of try to triangulate and say, okay, if we've got this real proponent of curbing alcohol consumption and he's giving numbers that are this, and then we've got somebody else who doesn't see it as a problem in society, he's giving these numbers, maybe neither one's a completely accurate number. I mean, that's what we do, right?
Yeah,
as well, historians.
It really is hard to say what the actual number is. And I think that that's still a problem right now. If you were to try to see how much alcohol people drink currently, like it can be up for debate, right? Because a lot of it has to do with self-reporting.
Yeah. I mean, if we went over to Pacific Beach on a Saturday night and asked how much alcohol people consumed, it'd be a very different number than if we went, to outside a church on Sunday morning.
Well, it depends on what church.
It does depend on what church. So, I mean, colonial Americans, did they drink a lot?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, a lot.
This is the thing. Even the most conservative figures are still a mind-numbing amount of alcohol. The average estimate is that your average British colonial American would have consumed about a half pint of rum in the morning to get started. That's, wow.
It's a lot of rum.
That's 8 ounces. That's a lot. To get started.
Yeah. Just to take the shakes away for the day.
Just to shake your shakes away. And it's funny. There was a whole kind of a day that you would kind of go through. And I want to talk about this really quickly, this kind of your daily
consumption,
like
yeah,
routine. And we know this because we've got a lot of early Americans who kept journals and they would talk about this. So like that rum in the morning was called an antiphlegmatic.
Yeah, so that's something important to think about, is that alcohol, when we're thinking about it, I mean, in our modern context, like, they're thinking of alcohol as helpful and medicinal. Like, it's as if they're waking up and they're taking a vitamin. Isn't that kind of what they think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think that's clearly what it was. You know, it's alcohol was considered by many to have medicinal benefits. And, you know, it's funny. I don't know. Would a half pint of rum get you going in the morning? It would. I mean, I think it might get you going for a little bit.
Well, I think it's really similar to a lot of addictions that Americans have currently.
Like checking their phone first thing in the morning.
Checking their phone first thing in the morning, and like sugar. I mean, we are so addicted to sugar and caffeine that, you know, a lot of people, when they wake up in the morning, like, the thing that gets them out of bed is thinking about a cup of coffee, right?
Oh, yeah.
And
I mean, if I don't have my coffee in the morning, I'm discombobulated the rest of the day.
Well, many people are. And do you get a headache?
No, I don't get a headache. I just feel very disconnected to everything. So maybe coffee's my anti-fogmatic.
I think it is. Yeah. I think the melancholy that sets in. A lot of people report having headaches if they haven't had their dose of caffeine for the day.
Yeah.
And so I think waking up and having a half pint of rum or whatever it is, I mean, I think that could kind of be considered equivalent to what we do currently with coffee. Oftentimes, you know, if you don't drink coffee, maybe tea, maybe some form of sugar. Think about the first thing that you consume in the morning, and how routine it is for you. And then think about, well, that's what rum was to colonial Americans. And we can look at it now and laugh and say, how horrible was that? But I mean, maybe in 100 years, they'll say, you know, drinking coffee or having sugar was really bad, right? But they're not looking at it as, oh, I have an addiction and I have a problem and I'm trying to party. That's another thing, right? Like, they're not trying to drink rum because they're trying to party. Like, that's just how they
start. Well, not in the morning.
No, later.
Later in the day, right? So, I mean, you would do what?
They kind of just have like this constant buzz going. Is that?
Oh, yeah. Well, so they drink rum first thing in the morning. And then mid-morning, it switches usually to cider, right? So, I mean, they can't drink water. Water has this, even though kind of North American water sources are much better than European equivalents as far as cleanliness goes and safety. You know, British colonists still felt that drinking water was not the best thing, especially if you lived in kind of an urban area. So they drank cider. So you drank some cider. Now, low alcohol content in it, but still, I mean, you're drinking cider. And if it's summer, you're going to drink more because you're thirsty. If you're doing physical labor, the amount you're going to consume is going to go up. So you would drink cider, and then if you happen to go somewhere to meet kind of friends or colleagues or anybody, you might drink some more cider at the middle of the day, right? And these aren't just adults. This is pretty much everybody drinking this cider. You know, the rum I don't think would have been something kids would do, but cider, everybody's drinking cider.
Yeah, it's just like the drink of choice. It's like having, you know, water around or something. And like you said, they can't have water really, because not only, you know, you did mention that it's a little bit safer to drink it in North America, but it just wasn't a part of the daily ritual either. I mean, they're bringing traditions over, right? Long-standing traditions of alcohol consumption, cider, rum, you know, and rum is something that's coming out of the Caribbean, right? But it just wasn't a part of their day to drink water. And so anytime they're drinking anything, it's going to have some sort of alcohol content.
Right. So they would, so you'd go down and meet friends and drink some more cider and do some more work, drink some more cider. You know, rum wasn't something you consume like in the middle of the day generally. But then as the day wore on, by the afternoon, you might meet friends at a tavern. And there it would either be rum, or if you were kind of west of the mountains, it'd be whiskey. If you were more inland. And, you know, we've previously talked about whiskey as this kind of really predominant commodity used in place of currency a lot of places. Plus they're consuming it, right? It's easy to make. A lot of the immigrants that are making it are Scotch-Irish immigrants. So you've got whiskey and, you know, so you start off with rum, you move to cider, and then you head on to whiskey. Wow, that's a lot. And it doesn't end there, especially if you're elite. Like if you were, I think if you were kind of a middling sort, kind of, it might kind of stop there. But if you were kind of aspiring to be like a colonial elite, you'd probably have some kind of evening entertainment or dinner plans, and then you'd kind of drink a lot during that. So you drink spirits at that point.
Yeah, with whatever meal you're having, you're having alcohol.
With whatever meal you're having.
Right.
Right. And then what better way to end the day than having a nightcap?
Nightcap, right.
So, I mean, many Americans would drink fortified wine because it was kind of sweet and it settled their stomach. But it also, it was viewed to have kind of medicinal benefits. But I mean, every waking hour, they've either just consumed some alcohol or they're getting ready to consume alcohol.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere all the time.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere. So, I mean, let's talk about how realistic this is, because this is gleaned from a bunch of different journals that people are writing. Is this the case for everyone in colonial America?
Well, I think that it's the case for most people and some like watered down version of it, right? I mean, I think that, right, you know, it depends on how thirsty everybody is, right? But right, the drink of choice being something that has alcohol in it, when somebody reaches for something to drink to quench their thirst, it is going to have alcohol in it. And I would say people were probably drinking more like cider. And what I've always wondered, though, and I don't know if, you know, the book got into this very much, but about women's consumption, right? Because a lot of times, a lot of the really hard liquor consumption is being done by men in taverns and in social, right, situations. And women may have been, you know, consuming cider and stuff all day, but I don't think that women are participating in this really hard liquor drinking, like you're describing with the whiskey and the rum and stuff. Is that?
It's maybe, I mean, it's hard to tell. There's definitely a gendered component to drinking, particularly kind of whiskey and rum to excess.
Well, and by the 19th century, it's most certainly gendered, right? We're talking about the colonial era now, but by the late 18th and early 19th centuries, drinking alcohol, right, is gendered, and many of the reform efforts that come from that are rooted in, you know, women's efforts to curb their, right, men drinking.
Well, and I think it's important to talk about in Britain at the very same time, kind of in metropolitan Britain, there's this movement going on where kind of spirits are being demonized as kind of this vice of the lower classes, and beer is the appropriate drink. You know, if you want something cheering, you drink beer. If you're kind of a debauched, kind of lowest of the low class in London, you drink gin. And, you know, so, and I think that's starting to kind of develop in colonial America, but not so much that kind of the whiskey and rum consumption are affected, because we don't actually reach our maximum alcohol consumption in the United States until 1830. So 1830, 7.1 gallons a person. And that's not 7.1 gallons of kind of low alcohol drink. That's 7.1 gallons. I think it's normalized to basically full alcohol. You know, so dozens of gallons of cider a year, whiskey, rum, particularly if you were kind of in the Northeast or in coastal America, not to mention kind of wine, beer, ale.
So we've definitely established that there's a lot of drinking going on, and we've kind of touched a little bit about why they were doing this so much. But one of the really interesting things that I have always gleaned from this is about thinking alcohol as being healthful, and just how much alcohol played into the daily life of somebody, and in any walk of life. So, you know, they thought that drinking alcohol kept them warm, and that's true to a certain extent. You know, you feel like you're warm, but you're actually not. And a lot of people will die of hypothermia because they think that they're warm, but they're just drunk. So you think that it keeps them warm. Then you mentioned that it aids, you know, with their digestion. But
it also makes people happier when they work. Right? I mean, there's this old Royal Navy tradition. So grog, everybody's heard of grog. They may not know what grog is actually. So grog is usually rum, kind of watered down with something else, usually water. And it comes from out of the British Royal Navy. And there's this Admiral E. Vernon who was famous for wearing this material called grogrum, which was a combination of silk and mohair. And he was a real proponent of changing from rum shares for sailors. So kind of this, to keep sailors happy in the Navy, there was this kind of, everybody was given a certain amount of rum every day. And he said, well, we should actually water it down so it goes further. And I think he also realized like full strength rum might have been affecting the sailor's performance a little bit. So he waters it down. It gets his name Grog or Old, because his name was Old Grog, his nickname. And I think you cannot disconnect, particularly in the Northeastern colonial region, from its British maritime connections, right? Its roots, the fact that these sailors are coming in and out of there. I mean, we talked last week when we talked about 1919, we talked about the Boston molasses flood. And that has to do with kind of rum being produced and distilled in Boston. And there's a huge amount of alcohol available for people, and it's cheap. Like domestic alcohol is so cheap compared to imported alcohol.
Well, and that's the thing. They wanted to have wine. That was kind of one of their goals when they started colonizing the New World. They think, well, we can grow a lot of, you know, there's a lot of land, so we'll grow a lot of grapes and we'll be able to make wine. And, you know, many Europeans were connoisseurs of wine and all that. But it turns out that North America and the region that they settled in the Northeast was actually not conducive to growing grapes at all. And in fact, it was rum that made more sense. And so the colonies ended up having hundreds of rum distilleries, making millions of gallons of rum annually. And the production of that was concentrated in the Northeast. And that's because it was made from molasses that was imported from the Caribbean sugar plantations. And so they started just basically working with what they had, with what they could work with. And it wasn't wine. And so the drink of choice does become rum to make and to consume because of the wide availability of sugar coming in from the Caribbean.
Right. So we've got rum, which has this Caribbean connection. And then we've got beer. And the Dutch are the ones who introduced kind of beer production, domestic large-scale beer production. They opened the first brewery in British North America. Well, I mean, I guess technically when they open it in New Amsterdam, it's not British North America. It's Dutch North America they open in. But they open it, I think it's like 1622. 1612. They open the first brewery. And, you know, these start to spring up all over the place. Anytime you start to have a town that kind of reaches a certain threshold population-wise, you'll have breweries that'll pop up. So you get that. So now you have beer as an alternative, which, you know, like I said before, in Britain itself, kind of beer is being viewed as a more reasonable alternative to hard spirits. But then you get whiskey production, which is inland. So the colonies weren't really good for growing grapes, but they were really good for growing grains.
Yeah. And many people noticed the lucrative opportunity for growing grain and then distilling liquor. And there was a lot of speculation and consideration into that of, you know, we can make a lot of money doing this. And because it was so part of everyday life, the production of alcohol became really important for a lot of people economically. And even George Washington was understood that, and Mount Vernon, you know, I think had distillery potential and stuff. Is that right?
Oh yeah. Mount Vernon became like a huge potential entrant into kind of,
it's interesting,
beer George production, Washington, whiskey production.
Yeah. He knows about the, about whiskey, right, and how important it is. And that's kind of part of the whole Whiskey Rebellion situation too, where the government knew that they could tax alcohol because people needed it to drink every day. It was so ingrained in a part of their everyday life that they knew that, well, if we start taxing this, it can make us a lot of money, the government a lot of money.
Yeah. So Washington, after he left the presidency in 1797, he's producing about 600 gallons of whiskey on Mount Vernon. By 1798, a year later, 4,500 gallons. And by 1799, 2 years later, 11,000 gallons of whiskey.
Yeah, he knows money's out, right?
And he was one of the biggest distillers in the United States at the time. I mean, it is ubiquitous, right? Whiskey is ubiquitous. It's kind of funny that rum looks like it's going to be the American drink, but whiskey kind of really supplants it because it's just so easy to get the raw material for it.
Right. They're not having to import it from the Caribbean. They're able to grow it and distill it right there on the spot. And so it does become more popular. But rum, though, is still the popular maritime drink, of course.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If you are a coastal city, rum is going to be much more popular. I mean, it's funny, but kind of before we get to talking about kind of the backlash to this drinking, I want to really quickly like describe a couple of these drinks because they just crack me up. The names are funny, but the ingredients. So stone fences. So what do you think is in a stone fence?
You know, I'm not a drinker, so I can't even begin to speculate, but I'm sure it's just a lot of alcohol.
Hard cider and rum.
Oh, yuck. That sounds really horrible.
What about a hot ale flip?
That sounds like hot cider. That sounds like that could be good. I remember like there was a drink at tailgates when it was really cold out that you drink hot cider, like apple cider with vodka, and it was hot. Probably wasn't vodka because they weren't importing vodka, right? But was it something like warm cider with alcohol in it?
Well, so a hot ale flip is ale, and then you add some rum to it, and some nutmeg, and then some eggs, eggs. And then guess how you warm it? This is what cracks me up. a red hot poker. You just stick the poker in the drink.
Oh, okay, that works.
And like stir it around. It's like a heat swizzle stick.
That's dangerous.
What about a rattle skull?
I don't know.
Beer, rum, and lime.
Wow.
What about a mimbo?
Mimbo, I don't know.
Rum and sugar.
Well, that sounds delicious. That's called rum punch.
Punches become this big thing, right? I mean, punches are this socially acceptable thing. Drinking in public, either whether it's at a tavern or whether it's at a party or whatever, is not looked down upon. Although inebriation is.
Yeah, you've got to keep it under control. I mean, it's the same today. Is that fair? I mean, we drink a lot in American culture today, too.
Not as much
as they did, but it's really common at social functions for people to have wine or drinks or things like that.
2.34 gallons in 2013.
And that's the average, right? So like I drink 0 gallons and somebody else may drink 5 or something, right?
But it's a big difference from 1830 to 2013.
That's true.
It's a huge difference.
That we work on college campuses, so maybe we think that drinking is absolutely more widespread than it is, because I see it often. There's a lot of drinking culture. But this dates back too to the colonial era, because Harvard had its own brewery.
And then there's the president gets fired because he did not supply sufficient beer to the students.
Right. So it's a serious situation. Yeah. I mean, this colonial drinking is also related to colonial colleges. It's related to colleges now today. It's like drinking culture is present in the colonial era. And oftentimes I think we think of, you know, like, oh, Harvard is so buttoned up or something, but not in the colonial era. And I'm sure.
No, 1639, the students. Yeah. 1639, the students get the president, Nathaniel Eaton, fired because he's viewed as not providing enough beer. And I think this is not just schools, but kind of artisan workshops as well. There was this idea that there was an exchange that if I am an apprentice for you, I work for you, you teach me how to do this job, but you also provide some drink for me. And that drink needs to be a certain amount. It needs to be kind of regular, that you owe more than just kind of training to me. There's a lot of other things you owe to me. And you even have situations where kind of indentured servants expect a certain amount of alcohol. Now, for slaves, it gets a lot different, right? Mm-hmm. Although there's still an amount of beer or cider or something being prepared, it's really watered down. But slaves really have no recourse if they feel they're not being given the right amount of cider or rum or whatever they deserve, right?
Right. Well, what ends up happening though with workers, I think it's interesting you point that out, because this is where the shift begins to happen, is that in workshops, when there's a specific amount of alcohol that needs to be provided for an apprentice or something like that, the shop owner is partaking right alongside. Right. Because
Working
right alongside one another, and they're drinking cider, you know, whatever it is they're doing in the workshop, building tables or something. I don't know. There's a close relationship between worker and boss where they are right alongside one another in the workshop. And so they drink together. But that starts to change when industry grows. And then there's actually like workshops where there's a separation. And this is starting to happen in the 19th century, where there's a separation between the shop owner and the workers. And then you start to see an emergence of a different class, like a middle class. And so there isn't the same level of camaraderie that's going on in a drinking sense, in a drinking culture, between shop owner and worker, as may have been happening in the colonial era all the way up through, say, the 18th century. There becomes a separation between people who are drinking and people and working and people who are in charge of them.
Right. And I think this, before we go to the worker thing, like talking about that tavern thing and the change that happens in that, there's this great book that I love. It's by Richard Stott. It's called Jolly Fellows, Male Milieus in 19th Century America. It's from 2009. And he actually talks about this moment when taverns are this very kind of class fluid environment. People can kind of talk with one another there, discuss things. And that starts to change in the 19th century. It starts to be a little bit more class oriented. Like you start to have taverns that are geared towards a specific segment of society. And eventually the taverns are going to get kind of outlawed. They're viewed as kind of these places where maybe men should not be hanging out, particularly once the idea of domesticity really starts to embed itself in kind of the early Republic.
Yeah, the domesticity situation, meaning, you know, the cult of domesticity, right? So thinking about the household and women's roles and all that, that definitely plays into it. But then there's also a lot of religious undertones here too. Especially getting into the 19th century, when you think about the Second Great Awakening, alcohol has started to be viewed as a vice and is something that needs to be confronted. And there are some people who believe this, of course, in the colonial era, but it's far outweighed. But by the late 18th century and into the early 19th century, you really start seeing alcohol as connected with lower class, debauchery, evil, vice, and something to be avoided. And then you also start having medical professionals lending their own advice about the consumption of alcohol, And then these medical professionals are also, I mean, I don't know how professionally you can call them at the time, but people who practice medicine in the late 18th century,
right.
They start to, you know, provide their own opinion that's religiously rooted, particularly in Quakerism.
Do you think Benjamin Rush is Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, he's one of these early guys who comes out and says, look, some people can't handle alcohol. And he says, taste not, handle not. He says, the only thing you can do if you kind of have an issue with alcohol is just avoid it. So he writes this work, Inquiry into the Effects of Ardent Spirits Upon the Human Body and Mind.
He was a Quaker.
Right. So do you think it's mostly his Quakerness that's making him do this?
Yeah.
But he says it's a mental condition.
Well, you have to think about, though, that their mental state is so connected to spirituality, right? That there's a lot of overlap. There's no such thing as really psychiatry at the time, but there's a lot of religiosity, and that's considered to be weighing on the spirit and the mind, right?
Right.
I mean, I can definitely see that there's a connection because he's a physician.
Right.
He's a politician and a leader in Philadelphia. He's connected to prison reform, also with his Quaker roots. But he sees that poverty is related to people drinking a lot, that debauchery is related to people drinking a lot. So he sees it as like a health crisis, but also a spiritual crisis. And I think when you have the health and spiritual crisis overlap, it becomes this moment for the soul, right? I mean, I think that there's so much interlaced there that he would say that there's an overlap between being a good person religiously and also abstaining from drink.
Right. Well, I mean, he says the use of strong drink is at first the effect of free agency. From habit, it takes place from necessity. So yeah, I could see how, I mean, the free agency thing particularly, it's this religious thing, but I think he also has a fear of the health effects and the social effects, right? I think it's fair to say Rush, though, is not approaching it from an industrial perspective, which is what we're going to get in the 19th century much more.
Well, he's promoting it, though, too. He's kind of the first person who identifies alcoholism.
Right.
As a physician.
Right.
He's the first, I think, to say, you know, this is actually a disease. Like, because
right.
that quote that you shared, that's like analyzing that quote. That's what he's talking about, is that there's an addiction that develops to drinking this substance that alters the mind. Therefore, it should be considered a vice and a disease.
Right. But he's not saying stop drinking because it hurts productivity.
No, that comes later.
Right. Right. So we get that in the 19th century. And that's really, I mean, so you've got the one strain, which is domesticity, which is, you know, maybe you shouldn't be drinking because it takes you away from your family. You spend all your time in these taverns. And then there's this other one, which is, you know, these early industrial people, figures really doubting how much alcohol their workers should be consuming.
Well, it's kind of interesting how that develops, though, because with the middle class, if you think about sort of an emergence of a middle class at this moment and the cult of domesticity taking over in terms of kind of controlling or mitigating the way that men behaved outside of the home as having levels of what is or is not appropriate behavior. And in order to establish themselves as being in a different class than the people who work for them, they cut back on the drinking as a means to differentiate. And women kind of control this sentiment, I think, a lot in terms of the cult of domesticity. But it also has to do with just wanting to say we're different than the worker bee, than the general worker bee.
Right. Right. That's a big thing with this cult of domesticity. So, I mean, the cult of domesticity and whether or not it really exists and how prevalent it is still kind of a debated topic among historians. But there's this idea that one way to separate, to differentiate yourself is to say, look, that family there, both the husband and wife have to work. Whereas my family, only the husband has to work. I don't.
And the wife and is in charge of this domestic sphere instead.
Right. And I'm allowed to, and I'm able to kind of create this morally pure, uplifting environment at home. So when my husband, who's been out in the kind of workaday world where it's very sinful and full of awful people, comes home, I can help purify him of that. And we have our family, and, you know, I'm in the, you know, not only do I comfort my husband, but I'm educating good little Republicans. And I mean little R Republicans at home so they can participate in the nation later. I'm educating them in the correct way to behave and all these things. And, you know, hard liquor is not the thing we're supposed to do. Now, I find it interesting, though, that hard liquor starts to really be demonized. But rum gets increasingly difficult for Americans to access after the Revolutionary War. I mean, they don't have the easy source of British sugar coming up from the Caribbean, molasses.
So you think that that plays into maybe cutting down a little bit in the drinking?
Maybe. I mean, maybe it does, because you really do see a lot of these kind of the moralizing sentiments that come out that or we would argue goes into this cult of domesticity are coming from coastal cities. It's not coming from the interior mostly. And I think maybe their supply of rum's been cut off and it's really expensive. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, in the interior, they're producing more whiskey than ever.
Yeah, so there's an uptick in consumption in certain regions and amongst certain mm-hmm. classes. And so
right.
what I think is important to pull out of this, too, is about the class distinctions, because with the development of taverns and people leaving work to go drink after they get off work, because drinking starts being looked down upon during the workday because, well, you're maybe not getting enough done. You're drunk, you know, so you're going to drink after you get off work. Well, wages are being spent in these taverns, and that's a huge portion of the reform effort, is to stop men from spending their wages on alcohol, because it directly impacts the family who, you know, needs money and who's scraping by, with hardly anything. And then, you know, the husband goes out and drinks all the salary away, or the money that he's earning away at the tavern. And people start getting kind of upset about this, and people meaning women, right? Women are really upset by this. And so you have this kind of teaming up of a reform effort amongst women, and then the men that have this emerging middle class who are saying, oh, that's beneath us. We don't do that anymore. We're not out drunk. We're not out spending our money like that. They're still drinking, but they're not drinking to a level of debauchery maybe that some of the wage laborers are drinking to after they get off of work. Still some similarities right. to today, right? I mean, when Friday hits, right. people often go out and celebrate the end of the work week by drinking. And I think people in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, they had these awful jobs and they're working their tails off, and they weren't really drinking on the job anymore like they may have been doing with you know, as an apprentice or something, because they're in these larger workshops in this industrial space. And so they drink when they get off of work, but they spend all their money at the tavern.
Right. And I think that's kind of another aspect of the reform movement that really starts to develop, you know, in the 19th century, the around 1830, is this idea that the working class actually can't manage their own affairs. And, you know, many people in the middle class, this kind of rising middle class, say, we're actually able to balance life better. So we're going to start to dictate things more and more to the working class. And, you know, it's an interesting thing that by, you know, 1830 is the year of highest consumption in the United States. By 1851, that's when the main law, the first law, kind of a prohibition, gets passed in a state legislature. and it bans the sale. It says the sale of liquor is a crime.
So that's pretty for that. Yeah,
that's really fast. Mm-hmm. I mean, to go within 20 years from the peak to now, states are stepping in and saying maybe we need to get involved in this. That this is out of control. But I mean, not drinking or consciously turning away has a history as old as the country itself, right? I mean, you get these Washingtonians in the early 19th century who are kind of pledging to eschew liquor. It's kind of ironic they call themselves Washingtonians, considering how much whiskey Washington was producing, as we talked about. But, you know, that the Jolly Fellows book that I discussed earlier, you know, Stott talks about this a little bit. And I think it's interesting. One aspect of tavern culture, of men going down and drinking in these taverns, was kind of telling these tall tales about how manly you were. And one way you talked about how manly you were was how many fights you got into and all these awful things you did. And when taverns start to not be an acceptable option to do that anymore, some of these men join these Washingtonians and they substitute their story of how debased they had become through alcohol for those old tavern stories.
Like what they had done in the taverns or...
Well, no, whereas in the tavern, they would have said how ridiculous they were, then they were drunk and it's like, oh yes. And I did this and this and this. Now that they don't think it's socially acceptable to go to the tavern anymore, they're joining these abstinence societies, these Washingtonian societies, and they get up and like tell their story of how they came to decide they needed to come to the Washingtonians, but it substitutes, like it's almost
or like.
Kind of, yeah. And it's like they're basically repackaging the same stories they would have told in the tavern.
Oh.
But now it's being told in
the light.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay. And it's so odd, right? That they're able to do this. But, you know, let's talk a little bit about industrialization. Because I think industrialization is the thing that really, I think, explains that 20-year change from the height of consumption to Maine passing a law.
I have a different argument. So if you want to take industrialization, go ahead. But I have a different argument.
Well, let's do your argument first. I think I know what your argument is. Let's do your argument first.
Well, I think it has to do with building institutions and social infrastructure that starts happening in the early Republic era, but really gains speed around the 1820s and 1830s, where institution building, meaning the common school, prisons, insane asylums, working houses, almshouses, right? All these different institutions that get built up by different states and then also funded by taxpayers in order to provide safety for the population, right? So if somebody's in prison because they've done something wrong, then they're being locked away from society. And so you have all these different institutions that are created, and oftentimes so many of them are are in business, so to speak, because there are people who are alcoholics, right? And we'll call them alcoholics now. They wouldn't have called them alcoholics then, but people who are in poverty, people who are committing crimes, people who are, participating in some form of debauchery in the streets, they're being filtered into these different institutions that are all taxpayer funded. And so my understanding of it is that this becomes a major economic burden on the taxpayer, that we're having to fund these institutions and funnel all these people who are just so debased and can't get their lives together into these different institutions that we're paying for. And so much of it is rooted in the consumption of alcohol.
It's pretty convincing. I mean, I think I'd never thought about the institutional approach. Let me give you my industrial.
Yeah, I think it's both, right? But let's go.
I think that's the thing is, I think it's the cult of domesticity. I think it's the institutions you've detailed. And I think it's this industrial thing. And I think there's probably a few other things we can throw into the mix as well. But U.S. industrial growth, I mean, the period we're talking about, this 1830 to 1850, sits right in the middle of this first big wave of industrial growth in the United States. And we can look at data and see. So in 1800, you have 1.7 or so million workers. This is the total labor force in the United States. Now, this does not count. These are wage laborers we're talking about. So these are people who are actually getting paid for their labor. So it doesn't include slaves, right? Because they're not getting paid. So in 1800, 1.7 million. 1810, we're up to about 2.3 million. But then by 1830, we're up over 4. And by 1860, we're at 11 million. So a huge growth in just the number of people in the workforce. But if we look at the farm laborers, people who are working in agricultural pursuits, it goes down. So in 1800, we're at about 83% of those laborers are working on farms. By 1830, it's 70%. And by 1860, it's just over 50%. And my argument is the shift to kind of industrial labor. So these are kind of factories and machine shops and kind of urban labor forces means the people who are paying wages don't want their employees drunk on their dime.
So that is kind of related to the institution argument though, too, because it's all an economically based argument.
Right.
Because yeah, they don't want to be paying for them to be degenerates while they're on the job. Most certainly. Right. I think that that's absolutely true. And then if you think about just the type of labor that's being done, though, so when you're moving from farm to factory, the labor is arduous. The hours are long. You're inside. Like the type of labor is just so different that's being done. And I think that people, there's an uptick in the consumption of alcohol just based on the conditions of their work. And it happens after work, but I think there's an uptick in the consumption.
Right. Well, I mean, I think there's an uptick in some, yeah, which might explain why suddenly you have states decide they need to get involved, right? Is that, you know, whereas you may have been used to on a farm having kind of cider and beer and maybe whiskey throughout the day, suddenly now you're kind of not allowed to do that for the 12 hours you're at work.
Well,
so when you get home, right. So when you get home, you kind of, there's this pent up desire for it.
And on top of that, there's the cities are becoming impacted. There's a lot of people packed into smaller spaces. And so when you have a group of drunk people that are doing whatever it is that they're doing in taverns or whatever, you know, creating kind of more of a chaotic environment, there's this idea of reformers that the society needs to be reformed, that you can't have people in large groups, you know, just roaming the streets drunk and going to taverns and all that. Like if you have a couple of people who are drinking on a farm back in say 1750, that's not really impacting anything. But with the growth of these cities, which is so absolutely related to the industrialization of the cities, there's a greater need for social order and for, you know, people to be behaving in a certain way. Like George Costanza, we're living in a society here, right? I mean, when you start having people who are all crowded together in smaller spaces, I mean, there's possibility that reformers are also thinking about that. It's like, we need to create standards and ways that we're going to behave in order if we're all going to be living all close to each other like this. We have to have social standards.
Right. Well, I think it's, yeah, there's definitely that. I think urbanization is definitely part of this as well. It's not a coincidence, but you know, I think circling back to our earlier discussion of the cult of domesticity, the rise of the middle class as the arbiters of what is socially acceptable in American society is critical for this, right? Their ability to claim the moral high ground in this argument is tied to yet something else we haven't really talked about, which is the Second Great Awakening, right? This religious revival movement. And a lot of people who are kind of involved in the Second Great Awakening are opposed to hard liquor at the very least, if not all alcohol.
There's so many different iterations of Christianity that creep up at this moment in time, right? So the Second Great Awakening and the period between 1820 and 1840, there are so many different religious revivals, and many of them do abstain from alcohol consumption, and because they're trying to create utopian societies.
Right. There you go. Right there. You just said it. A utopian society for them, for the 1830 mindset, is a society without alcohol.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. Yeah. No, I think you've got Mormons, Seventh-day Adventists, you've got all of these groups coming out of kind of New York, that burned over district, who prohibit the consumption of alcohol. You've got a lot of the kind of itinerant ministers that are moving around the country, kind of preaching abstinence, talking about the evils of alcohol. And I think it's kind of this perfect storm from 1830 to 1850. All of these things come together, and it leads to like Maine enacting this law and other states following quickly and kind of doing the same thing, kind of banning the sale of liquor. Now, Maine, it was liquor, right? It wasn't beer. It wasn't cider. It was liquor. And liquor is kind of the one that's mostly demonized, right?
Yeah, liquor is demonized. And yeah, there's a huge difference between, because the consumption of beer, cider, things like that, it's like, well, what else are you going to drink? Because people were getting sick drinking water, so they were drinking right. other things. But yes, it's liquor that's demonized. And it's because of the context in which liquor is consumed also, that it's not consumed to quench thirst necessarily. It's consumed to reach a straight state of drunkenness, which is considered to be a vice, which is considered to alter the state of mind. And so that's kind of the issue there. But connected to this as well, I think, is the increase in immigration. So we were talking about the distinction of classes that really starts to emerge in this industrial period, the Second Great Awakening period, this age of reform. There's also a distinction that's being made on nationality, right? So when you have a bunch of immigrants coming from Ireland and they're working, you know, this wage labor kind of jobs, that's another way to form a distinction, a class distinction, away from them, because they're also coming with their traditions of heavy drinking as well in the countries where they're from. Not that it's any different than American drinking necessarily, but that's another way to distinguish class too, and to separate the native, so what they called themselves, right? These nativists from new immigrants to these bigger cities, is to say, well, we're not, you know, we're not like them because we're not debased, and we're not, you know, participating in all of this heavy drinking and spending of the wages and just doing things that are not socially acceptable.
Right. Right. It's a waste, right? They start to portray kind of this stereotypical Irish working class man as unfit to even care for his own family. Right, that he takes the wages that should be used to support his family, and instead he goes out and drinks it away, forcing his wife to have to go out and actually work, and work for women is increasingly viewed as unseemly.
Yeah, so it's women who are kind of at the helm of this too. And I don't want to diminish it either, because the women who are finally coming, you know, out into a more political sphere to say we need to curb the consumption of alcohol, it's women who are trying to demand a space and a voice in society. And they're also saying, not only are husbands spending all of this money on alcohol consumption and we can't feed the kids, but they're coming home and beating us up. I mean, that's
right.
That's one of the things that women discuss finally, openly and publicly by the mid-19th century, is spousal abuse, and that women don't have a voice, they don't have a meaning, they don't have any political clout, they have nothing, right? And so this age of reform.
Well, they have, in most, right, most states, they don't have the ability to sue for divorce.
No, they have no right to property.
They have little recourse.
Children.
Right.
Sorry, I was talking over you.
No, that's fine. No, I think we both get passionate about this because it's like this moment. And I think what's interesting is this, and there's this argument, does temperance train the women who move into the abolitionist movement, or is it vice versa? Many of these women are involved in religious movements coming out of the Second Great Awakening. I mean, I think they're all together. There's a reason all of these things are happening together, because one of the tenets of some of the people preaching during the Second Great Awakening is moral perfection, right? Moral perfectionism, this idea that Americans can actually make a heaven on earth immediately. They can change what we do and make it a perfect place. And for a lot of reformers, that's the call for them to say, look, we actually have a reason we need to go out and stop these awful things. Even if my husband is not, you know, coming home and beating me, I know this other woman who it happens to her, and I know these other people it happens to. And you know, it's easy for them to kind of get training in one form of social reform and then use it in others, right? And then you've got women's suffrage that's mixed up in this too, right? A lot of these women are also involved in early women's suffrage movement.
Right, and that starts to happen by 1848. You have the Seneca Falls Convention, where women finally get together in a large meeting to have a declaration of sentiments that says, we want enfranchisement in our government. And it's all very much related to temperance movement, the movement for abolition, the movement for the common school. This age of reform has so many different facets to it. And there's so many different sub-themes that we can go off of to discuss all of the different reform efforts that happen in this time. And I'm sure that we will get into these in more detail in other episodes. But kind of a baseline foundational, I think, topic is what we're discussing, and that is the prevalence of alcoholism and how it impacts every segment of life, and that people in this era start to kind of figure that out, you know, that this alcohol consumption, this thing that we do so much that we've not really thought about as being bad, it's actually kind of impacting every single aspect of our lives, and it's starting to become a burden onto the taxpayer. And whenever something becomes a burden on taxpayers, that's when reform starts to happen.
Right, right, right. Yeah, it's the idea that, well, now we're having to support poorhouses because, you know, this guy spent all his money on whiskey. Maybe there's a way I can stop this from happening before it even gets to that point. I think one thing that's important to say, though, is this is, I think, why there's this confusion and an attempt to blame women for prohibition. This is where it starts, right? This idea that because the people who seem to have the most to gain by involvement in abolition are women, that they must be to blame for abolition. And I think that's an oversimplification of it. Prohibition. And I think that's just a gross simplification. And it's also coming from it and saying, look, prohibition's a bad thing. You know, these women came up with it. Not really, right? I mean, women and men are coming up with these ideas. And kind of early temperance movement never sought to ban all alcohol.
Well, and it's one of the first things, though, that women become passionate about and become political.
Well, they're allowed to.
Yeah, that they're publicly speaking out against. And that, yeah, and the temperance movement, the temperance unions and the, you know, club women that come together to form these temperance unions, they start in the 19th century. And it does become kind of the thing that they're most passionate about. I mean, and then that does, you know, kind of flow into other movements and other reform efforts, but there's always the foundational passion toward curbing the consumption of alcohol, which we've lost. I mean, I don't think that that exists in our modern American culture, that there's alcohol consumption.
There was Mothers Against Drunk Drivers for a while, but they were involved in more in bigger things like discouraging teenage drinking and things like that. But they kind of became a joke, right?
What?
Like everybody made fun of them.
I'm making fun of them. I mean, I do know that they, that their movement is heavily rooted in what we're talking about today, but I didn't know that they were the subject of ridicule.
I remember seeing a lot of, I mean, a lot of comedians would joke about them, a lot of parody sketches on kind of sketch shows and things. I think they're still around. But yeah, I think societally we don't take that seriously.
Women seriously in our society, to be honest. I think everything women try to do, people think is silly. Maybe broader discussion.
Right. I mean,
I don't think it's interesting. Seriously, that's the problem.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely the 19th century could be called, we don't take women seriously. Most of the 20th century could be called that as well.
Right at this moment.
I mean, I think we hope the 21st century isn't, but maybe you're right, right? Well, I mean,
I don't want to get too far off topic, but think about the Me Too movement. I mean, people have completely laughed it out of the room at this point. And we're talking about sexual assault of women. And of course, there are instances where it has, gone in directions where it's like, well, that's not really the core of what we're discussing here. We're trying to just get to the root of women are being sexually assaulted. And it's become a punchline, right? I mean, I hear it all the time. I hear it all the time. People will come, and I've had men come up to me and be like, oh, is it okay if I hug you? You know, me too, me too. And it's like, it's a joke, right? And that's
right.
Maybe we need to cut this out because this is getting too political, but I just think I think that that's the kind of the core of the issue when we're talking reform is like women's issues often get laughed out of the room and movements that women get behind for reform efforts in society are often laughed at by men, and men are the ones who are still predominantly in charge. So.
But I mean, that's what makes it so remarkable that abolitionism, which for the white population is largely gendered female, right? Many more abolitionists are women than men in the white community.
Yeah.
And alcohol. I mean, all of these topics that these reform movements they're interested in, the fact that they're able to get stuff done is kind of remarkable that even though they're kind of being dismissed, they're able to kind of push through and get these things done. Tells us something, right?
Yeah. How much consumption went down over a 100-year period, something changed. And so that's
something changed. But I wonder, I think part of the reticence now to consider alcohol a societal problem today is I think Americans really have kind of turned back to a very kind of Puritan way of viewing vice and saying, well, that's your own failing. Those are your moral, you're morally a failure, right? If you give in to these vices, that's your problem, right?
I would say that's true. But I also think that there is a more widespread liberal view of social ailments now that we just, I think that we're just kind of a little more tolerant about people's vices. I think that we promote.
So we put up with that guy that gets drunk at every like faculty party.
I haven't experienced that personally, but.
But I mean, are we supposed, is that the idea that we just kind of have to deal with it?
Well, I don't know. To do with being actually drunk and like, I'm not talking about actual drunkenness and blacked out drunk or something, but so many social events revolve around alcohol. Events that are like, ooh, highbrow, like, oh, come to this wine tasting and stuff like that. Like, it's considered genteel to consume alcohol in certain contexts amongst certain people. And that's not gone away. That's always been the case, but it's certainly not gone away in the 21st century. And we know that alcohol is bad for our health. I mean, we know that studies now about the effect on our brain, the effect on our liver, the effect on our psyche, the effect on our motor skills and our abilities to think and function and do things. And we know that alcohol is bad for our health. And yet there's absolutely no discussion about curbing alcohol consumption. And as a matter of fact, we've started to allow more drugs into society to say, like, you know, like we've just become a lot more lax about what we think is okay for people to be consuming. And I see it going in that direction. And like, I'm pretty, you know, nonchalant about it. It's like, I think people should be able to do whatever they want. I think it's like individuals should choose however they want to spend their money and their time. Right. So my own viewpoint on it is that, but I think that we are all moving that direction as a society. Like, I don't see major reform efforts coming to the fore anytime soon. I think we're heading in
the
direction. I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with
more legalization of multiple different drugs. And why though? Because again, criminalizing these actions, right? Like criminalizing drugs, alcohol, all this stuff, it's a drain on the economy. A lot of people are in jail and it's costing taxpayers a lot of money. So like, I don't see any time in the near future where we're going to be having any sort of moral reform or anything surrounding our consumption.
Right. Wow. I think we ended up in a very interesting place here. And I think it gives us kind of some other topics we're going to touch on. I know, you know, we're going to talk about prohibition kind of in the 1920s before the end of this year, before the end of 2019, because you remember that Volstead Act comes into effect at the end of 1919 in October. And I, you know, we can continue the discussion then and we can kind of talk about why prohibition becomes unraveled almost as soon as it's implemented, right? The society kind of pushes back against it right from the beginning. But I think this kind of the war on drugs, I think, would be a really interesting topic too. Kind of talk about the war on drugs and kind of, I know it's a little bit of both of our comfort zones as far as history goes, because neither of us is really a 20th century historian.
I grew up in the age of DARE though. I mean, I was going to school when they had all these like DARE to stay off drugs. Like that whole campaign was like my childhood.
Right.
I mean, I used to have like the Red Ribbon Week and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, this has been great. This great conversation. Thanks a lot. Yeah. Thank you for joining us this week on An Incomplete History. I hope you enjoyed our discussion about alcohol in the early Republic and how drunk or not drunk colonial Americans may have been. Join us every week for new episodes of An Incomplete History. You can find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you subscribe to podcasts. If you haven't done so, please do us a favor and rate us and give us a review on Apple Podcasts. That helps us, that increases the visibility of the podcast. You can also go to our website, unincompletehistory.com. You can leave comments there. You can also see kind of show notes and things. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. All those links are on our website. Until next time, I'm Jeff.
And I'm Hillary.
Thank you for joining us at An Incomplete History.